Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of Full Stack Whatever. This is episode 45, where we catch up with Aaron Carambula. Carambula. That's always what I say. He was drinking water. That was almost a spit take. So if you have not heard Karen, if you have not heard Karen, wait, did you mute yourself? I can't hear you laugh because I know you have a big laugh.
I did mute myself because I wanted your intro to be clean, but here you go.
Wow. Wow. If you have not heard Aaron on the show yet, Aaron was here for episode 19, where we talked about his experiences on the marketplace team as a whole, currently at eBay, where he's been over a year now. But yeah, it's the new year and we thought we'd catch up. So happy new year, Aaron. And what's up?
Hey, Michael. Happy new year. What is up? Do you do new year goals? Anything like that?
New year goals? Oh, I had this whole post in 2015 about goals, not resolutions. I think that is still on Medium somewhere.
I might have just stolen that then.
New year's goals, monthly resolutions. That was like a whole shtick. It was mostly that if you do the resolution and then you fail, a lot of us immediately are just like, well, resolution's gone, you know.
Try again next year.
January 15, start drinking again. And so my idea at the time was, and I kind of still do it this way, is if you just do the resolution on a monthly basis and, you know, you mess up halfway through the month, then you basically on the first of the next month, you can pick up again. And so this year around, I really wanted to get back in shape again. And right. I actually started doing that the first week of November.
Oh, you got the jump on the new year.
Yeah. There's all this momentum into the new year. Nice. So even though the Christmas break and a little bit of traveling couldn't really get in the way because I got a couple runs in. And so once it's kind of flowing, you know, it's easier to keep going. But it's definitely, I think, making sure that you have a small time window where like, you failed, fell off the wagon. Okay, not this week. Well, then the other week, basically.
Right.
Or, damn, I'm not like getting to 3 workouts this week. Hey, at least I got one in. Kind of feels like a bridge loan in a way. But what about you? Do you have any resolutions or goals for this year?
Well, when we moved to Minnesota in September, I resolved to spend time outside and basically biked every single day. So not unlike your goal, I started in September. And you're right, kind of nice to get the head start. Maybe it's the only thing that makes sense ahead of the holiday season to move forward. Black Friday always starts a little earlier every year. Maybe it makes sense to grab your New Year's resolution and just get started ahead of the holidays to keep the momentum. But yeah, I mean, so my goal is to ride 100 miles. You saw Jasper is doing like mega rides now, ultra
endurance
kind of things, yeah.
Does he bike all the way up like to the north point of the country and then back down? Yeah, I saw that, yeah.
I could probably swing that here in Minnesota. I could probably bike to the border and back. But I think this year I'm just going to make sure I hit at least one century ride before the summer.
Oh, wow. So one 100 mile ride. Before the summer.
Yeah, so I'll work up to it, hit that, and then see where to go.
That's a great goal.
Yeah. Also, and no off-season, too. I'm trying to ride in the snow, which is fun.
Yeah, I think that the most ironic thing of you being in Minnesota now and biking is that probably the safest place to bike is on the lake.
Yes.
There's at least no cars there, you know?
Yeah, got studded tires, and I can just rip out on the lake a couple miles, leave the house, really. Just bike right out the garage.
When we were talking about this earlier today and we weren't recording, I was like, do you have a guest room? Because that sounds amazing. I mean, California is great and all, but like a frozen lake, being from the Netherlands, there's always this desire to have. So there's this whole big thing in the Netherlands, which is called the 11 City Tour, which is this like natural ice race called Elfstedentocht, which is like a very, of course, Dutch kind of word. It's up in a northern province called Friesland. It's a good name.
Oh, come on.
And basically, you go through 11 small cities, but you know, every year there's this like big buildup on, is the ice going to be thick enough? Because there's like tens of thousands of people, I think, that do this. That once it becomes clear that they're getting close, people start like flying in and stuff. I'm just like Wikipediaing it just to not butcher it. 120 miles, so almost 200 kilometers long, which is like a speed skating competition. And then there's also a marathon. So the actual competition is about 300 people. And then the marathon is 16,000 skaters.
Oh my God.
Basically. So the biggest ice skating tour in the world. But the last one, it was in 1997.
Oh.
And so there is this like spot in time every year where, it freezes a couple days more.
is it gonna
and then
make
all of
it,
a sudden, yeah. not especially now with social media, like it's, you know, the thickness of the ice at every spot gets shared onto the internet. And so right. people it's really like, start preparing for it.
Anticipation rises.
I grew up in the completely other part of the country where we didn't really have that. But, you know, the fever, you know, they always call it the fever of a tour.
The Friesland
fever.
All
over the country. Like it was like the local news of the whole country, basically. Like everyone would know about it.
That's awesome.
But yeah, that's a little funny piece of trivia for all the tech people that are like, why the hell are we talking about skating?
Well, when it freezes, I guess we got to go like everybody else.
Totally. It's just great to kind of catch up and not have a format, because the last one we were like kind of talking about your past experiences and
the journey.
Also because you have such a broad journey behind you and still like leading design at eBay. But then I know you have some, you know, side projects always popping up, and there's always your desire to do typography. So it's always very interesting. A couple of things that we already talked about before the show that we wanted to dig into was some of our favorite partners in our careers.
Yes.
It's also performance review season. So we were kind of talking about that a little bit, about, you know, the best feedback we've gotten, the worst feedback we've gotten, things we've learned about performance reviews along the way. And then we'll talk a little bit about like, you know, team dynamics and leadership dynamics and that kind of stuff. So there's no real like set format for this one. So you'll just kind of hear us casually like meander through a couple of different topics. But the thing that really kind of kicked off our point of talking about great partnership was Craig Campbell was one of our past colleagues. He's currently starting a little company called Past Maps, where he really wants to make it easy for people across the US to find historical maps on the different areas. And his like project right now just like superimposes all these old maps on top of a Google Maps style like interface, so you can kind of navigate through and see something like San Francisco in 1925 or something like that.
It's so freaking cool.
Like, it's super
like,
cool.
Like I was following him for a while. He's sharing his journey on Threads and I hadn't clicked the link yet. And then one day I was like, okay, now he's asking design questions, I'm gonna go check this out. And I went down a rabbit hole in my new area for 3 hours overnight. I was like, way too late.
Mm-hmm.
Just like browsing these maps and then like looking up the things that were made obvious on them, like looking them up on Wikipedia or whatever to see what was the story behind the change or like the thing that is no longer there. Like there are railroads, they're now biking trails. And I was like, cool to see when they appeared on the map and when they disappeared from the map. Let's go learn about the whys. It's so freaking cool. Because and you learn like these stories of like these frontiers people who, you know, left everything behind. And I don't know, you just start to get to really personal places with space and the space you occupy.
The thing that I think is also interesting about that is if and when a map goes back to the late 1800s or something.
Yeah, that's an old map here. That's an old map in the States. Yeah.
That is not that long ago, like no. relatively. In certain cases, you can see the interstates being built, and you yep. can obviously see like
the impact of redlining and all that sort of stuff shows up apparently. And we got into a bit of a who can help Craig competition. But so he's doing his startup thing, sharing it all on Threads. He's asking for a little bit of help here and there, or just sharing what he's doing. And so a bunch of us end up jumping in, trying to be helpful. He was like, oh, here's my, oh, what was he working on? The share?
It was the Open Graph images.
Oh, the OG images. It came through to me as, oh, I need help learning how to use Figma to export images. So I'm not just screen capturing these things. I was like, okay, easy to help to give on Threads. Gave him a quick tutorial. But then in comes Michael. Never wanted to just give some advice. You just redesigned his shit.
I mean, it wasn't even like necessarily the redesigning of the shit. It was really just this point of I spend a significant amount of time on Open Graph images for the podcast. And then I would design one and then I would throw an episode out and then I would look at, you know, at the time, Twitter, not really publishing there anymore, but, and then on Threads and, you know, Facebook and LinkedIn and like the different like iMessage and like the different spots. And it makes you realize, you know, the variability of the mileage of an image basically, because, right. you know, the internet says, I think it's like 1200 by 630 is like the recommended image size.
Right.
But then, you know, you can do that and then fine, you can make images that way. You know, you just listen to that exact thing. But truly what that implicitly means is that 1200 to 630, that aspect ratio is the safe zone, roughly.
Right.
And then if you test it, it's actually not. The implementation's all over the place, not that consistent.
Right.
And so I like made a joke to Craig because the logo was green and then the background was like a color of brown. And so it was like super muddy. And so I was like, hey, you know, do you have a Figma file? Because that thing is giving me heartburn. and so then I opened the Figma file and I looked at it and I was like, oh yeah, okay. There wasn't really like a lot of method to it. And
right.
I'm not at all a great illustrator, but I'm really good at being methodical with all these different art boards. And so what I did was like front to back, I would change one thing about the image and then I would write above it what I did in that iteration. Then I would change another thing. I would write above it what I did. I would change another thing and then, you know, show him the like safe zone, kind of the way that you do. It's probably not as relevant anymore nowadays, but
right.
The way that you used to have, like when you were recording something, you would always make sure that like you had a couple of grid and crop lines on yes. your video, because there were so many different devices that things yeah. would show up on. Right. And, like, and so, yeah, you have letterboxing. Only true letterboxing that happens these days right now is probably, you know, when you work with DaVinci Resolve and all that tracking where you make something that is a landscape aspect ratio and you turn it into a story.
Right.
Then you're tracking letterboxing. It's a whole different thing. But the true application of letterboxing nowadays, probably only airplane displays or something. Like airplane screens, you know, like
I have to say from my end, though, a lot of e-commerce, you'll go to some e-commerce sites that are portrait, some that are square. Some of our landscape. And so,
yeah,
same thing there.
Keep exactly.
The, square, the safe square.
And so this ended up being like, I think 5 or 6 little mini evolutions of a design and then making sure that it wasn't like brown on green and then, you know, putting the logo kind of in a safe space. But I think that's what's really interesting about open graph images just as a topic is just this like really big nerdy thing that I'm still super interested by, because somewhere throughout the last decade, you know, this is like Instagram and Facebook photos and Flickr being the lightning rod into a more visual internet culture, right?
Right. Like
internet speeds were growing, mobile internet speeds were growing. Instagram kind of does the whole like 640 max
resolution
thing, where because internet at the time wasn't that fast yet, or like mobile, like internet wasn't that fast yet. It was like the first iPhone was still on GPRS and Edge, I think, in the US,
oh,
which
man,
wasn't really a standard.
Yeah, the E.
And that was really slow because all those Windows mobile devices were already doing 3G, but then the second like version became a 3G phone, and then 3G was getting faster, and then all of a sudden we got LTE, right? And so like everything gets faster, and the more bandwidth we have, the more that we can start sharing images. And so somewhere along the way, links kind of get extremely boring, like a blue underline, random thing.
Yeah.
Jacob Nielsen, like circa 1995, gets...
Well, and also so much more sharing happening and URLs becoming just ridiculously unwieldy.
Yes, that too, yeah. URLs got very long. There were actual whole companies that were like URL shorteners because Twitter would count it into your 140 characters or whatever it was at the time,
140
right?
plus name, yeah.
Yeah, and so then what you got was eventually Twitter like started doing them like themselves, and so they started auto shortening them, and so that allowed people to like kind of share a little more. But still, in the feed of images and the feed of, you know, videos being shared and all this kind of stuff, a link doesn't really stand out. And so then very early on, we obviously started going into this like open graph way of sharing, which one of the few truly standard things, and we don't even use them in that standard format. It's different websites read out different like tags, and you can add like custom meta whatever to it.
And credit where it's due, right? Sharing activity on other platforms to Facebook through the Open Graph also necessitated a little bit more of a preview, right? So if you pin something on Pinterest, you need to preview it on Facebook when it's shared. It can't just be a boring link that doesn't really make it part of the engaging, you know, newsfeed.
Yeah, and so I think still like to this day, I love, you know, the ability to do something once or do something once correctly per a standard, and then, you know, having that work in so many different environments and media and different like aspect ratios, etc. Yeah, this was like one of those fun ones.
So you're just having fun making a really tidy Figma file for a friend.
I know. Yeah. My office is a complete hellhole of crap everywhere, but giving a friend a tidy Figma file is how I try to compensate for that. But no, so kind of talking about Craig kind of led us to talk about, you know, like different people that we work with and kind of the qualities that we really enjoyed. And I think I've had the great fortune of working with some amazing engineers, Craig being one of those, kind of also going back to like early Instagram, and, you know, Pete Hunt has already been on the podcast as well.
Mm-hmm.
The ability when you're working with a partner where there's a difference in working alongside someone and working with someone.
Mm.
And that's definitely been something that's become more and more clear over me the last 5 years or so, where if you truly work with someone, or you like truly feel like you're a partner with someone, then whatever you do as a job and whatever they do as a job, the lines get very blurred very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And this can be one person, this can be a group of people. And so really what you start seeing is there's like, you know, truly nothing in this is someone else's problem. And this is obviously
also
a famous Facebook poster that was all over campus, right? Like nothing at Facebook is someone else's problem. Like I think they try to like kind of scale and instill that. But there's definitely like pockets of my career where I can go back to, and the first dedicated iOS engineer at Instagram, like Ryan Gamba. Like it's the time where you don't have to show finalized designs, you know?
No handoff.
There is no handoff. Like yeah.
Because you're hand in hand.
You just give them access to the draft files, and there's no need to do all the edge cases and the corner cases, because like as someone that develops like that starts thinking through it, then they will list out the edge cases. And if there's something that they can come up with that's not within the standards or the little baby design system that you already built, oh, how do we alert this? Then that is the one question that comes out of it. But
you know, that's such an interesting like heuristic for what that partnership looks like when you don't put up barriers between each other, right? Like, don't give me a design until it's done.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
And people can put the barrier up around themselves. I don't want to share it until it's done.
Yeah. Oh, a lot. And a lot of that comes from having had previous experiences where your design work gets criticized in a way that is probably at best inefficient and at worst in bad faith.
Right. And when you open that up, when you bring all the barriers down, the work gets really good. You can go ahead and design in real time together.
Mm-hmm.
You can even plan in real time together. Oh, what do you need now? What are you going to need next? Instead of sitting down and trying to plan that all out a priori, you're just like actually getting into it together. And then there's no, oh, why'd you make me throw away code? It's like, no, because we both got to play with it at the same time. And we both had the same sort of, we had our own reactions to it. We found ways to make it better and we wanted to. And there's even a cooler thing too, right? Where like you start to raise each other's standards. Because they start to understand what you're seeing and you start to understand what they're seeing in the experience, in the code, even in the potential of what you're making. And you keep wanting to push it because you've got somebody there who you want to do right by, right? You're trying to make each other proud of what you're making together. It all escalates towards excellence. When you've got all these barriers around, though, it's like, oh, I just want to get this thing done enough that I can get it over to them so I can not be in their way. And then I can move on with the next thing I'm going to do. Which is terribly isolating. And no, like the only thing that can happen there is you get feedback like, hey, the designs were incomplete.
And the concept of being blocked in that world, it still happens, but it's drastically reduced.
And so such a less stressed thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And what I've always found really pleasant in those, at least in those like design or engineer relationships is, hey, if I haven't gotten to something yet because I truly have to hand off this other thing first, or like some, there's another priority that's come across my plate, or there's a review that's popped up, whatever happened, just sitting down with someone that you're in a partnership with like that is you draw a bunch of boxes on a piece of paper. You're like, this is roughly going to be like this. This is roughly going to be like that. As you do that and as you talk through it and as you finish your work and you come back, you already get a stub or like an early V0 version of that work. What I think is great about it is because you work in parallel so much, learnings of what's good and bad come from both angles.
Yes.
And so instead of the designers will always complain, and PMs also will always complain about the typical, you know, engineer says no situation, you know, like, well, we can't do that, right? But that relationship is always on yes. And then when the engineer in the partnership, maybe they get stuck, and because you work so closely together, you talk to each other every day and, you know, you just have a casual conversation and they're like, oh yeah, I'm doing this thing. I'm kind of stuck on it. I've been doing this 3 hours now. I thought it would be done in 5 minutes. And then you can say, well, actually, do we need that? You know, is there another way around this? Like A, do we need it? B, can we do it differently? C, do we need a bit later or something? Or can we ask someone else for help? And then in something that seems very linear, because I think a lot of product development these days, especially as we like kind of bloom these companies and brought you know, trio models with PMs, engineering managers, or tech leads and designers. A lot of this feels, you know, people call it waterfall model. You can call it like serialized, like ways of working is like, oh, this block is done. Now someone else can do that block. And instead you both look at the problem together sometimes someone does something else. It becomes much more of a dance, and it becomes much more flexible. And you do realize that actually in this case, we really didn't need to invest time in this.
Right.
We're not right now. But you just saved the company two weeks of your eng time in a way. Yeah. No, you just saved the company two weeks of your eng time in a way, right? And you can spend that on something else.
That's right. There's always some sort of like, oh, we need to build an interface for this. That I remember, you know, engineers being like, okay, my next thing is I need to do an interface for this. We already did that. We made an interface that'll work right here. Oh, right.
Yeah, just grab that and move it over here.
Yeah.
Or in some cases, and I think this is blame always, or like ownership always, is like very much a shared concept. But in a lot of cases, the lack of designers even asking the question of like, hey, should this even be a screen?
Right.
They're just going to design the screen. And you kind of start realizing, well, in certain cases, the best thing is no thing.
Yeah.
And so instead of making this whole flow, can we automate this? You know, one of the things that was always interesting, and a lot of companies have to do this now, especially when you're a smaller company, it's like, if you're a smaller company and you're doing anything in the EU with customer data, you have to adhere to GDPR. If you're small, you have priorities that are building features, dealing with competitors, trying to grow fast, doing all these things. It's really anti-competitive. And this is obviously the big argument against GDPR, or like
the old regulatory capture game.
Yeah, the regulatory capture thing where, you know, Facebook, Google, Apple, all these large companies have a team or an army that focus on these things. And they have to because they have large customer bases.
Mm-hmm.
But if you have smaller customer bases or smaller user bases, your GDPR flow is likely an internal tool. Someone will email this thing. And then you're like, okay, well, someone's job is now to do that thing. Because building a tool to make that fast at that moment in time doesn't make any sense. And so what you've actually designed there is you've designed a process. You haven't even designed a product, basically.
Right.
And in a lot of cases, you know, I remember this. I was doing this with like Shoebox because it was like a side project. I eventually need to figure out how to optimize the resolution of my images. And how to do that. The best way that I can do it right now is to just save the raw files. And that's just not going to work over time.
Right.
Because that's going to take a lot of, you know, space on AWS, whatever. It's going to cost money eventually. But at the point where it's going to cost money, which is where AWS sends me like 34 cent credit card charges right now. It's like at the point where that like hits, you know, double digit dollars or something, then it's all of a sudden like, okay, now there's this, you know, now we need to do like this next step, kind of like I didn't really have to do anything here. That like investing in this from an engineering perspective didn't really make sense. It also reminds me of there just recently on HBO or on Max, whatever you call it, there's a new Y2K documentary that came out. And it reminded me that you know, the big Y2K problem was that they stored all of the years in like two digits because it was in the 1900s basically. And so, but then you think back and you think about these rooms in, I don't know, the 50s and 60s with these giant machines that were like physical manifestations. Yeah, two bits were very expensive at that time. A lot of people, even in the documentary, are like, well, you know, why didn't they think of this, blah, blah, blah. That's kind of not like looking ahead, but it's like, I mean,
that was a future problem.
Yeah.
We'll solve that with technology then.
That is a future problem. Yeah.
Or lots and lots of money, you know, with a lot of CD-ROMs going through people like my hands
for
a little cottage industry.
But the thing that was also interesting, I mentioned this to a friend last night, and he was telling me that 2038 is going to be another one of these moments, because that is when the UTC timestamp value goes out of a 32-bit window.
Oh, man.
And so everything that's 32-bit will think that it's a completely different time again, because it'll be the 99999.
Go back to zero.
Or yeah, whatever it goes to. Clearly not as technically adept on that topic. And that's going to be a tough one, right? Because, you know, the millennium, big number, easy to market, you know. 2038, it's also not just January 1st, 2038. It's like somewhere in 2038, you know, there's going to be this thing, which is like 14 years from now.
The Y2K38 doesn't have the ring to it.
It does not. It is not at all. But I do think a lot of what you find in this partnership, I think, is also the, okay, what's the right thing for now? Or when you as a designer come up with, hey, this is the right thing for now. And then someone in engineering is like, but it takes me like an extra hour to make it sure that it's right for now and for the future.
Right.
There's like kind of this like true partnership. And then I think on the flip side as well, so because the core of the topic is still partnerships and like great peers that we've worked with. Yeah, I think we personally, both of us also have examples that I at least am aware of, both like from the Facebook time, where that level of flexibility and that level of partnership was also, right, not even if you were lucky, but in many spots within that company, the relationship with product. Like, you could just have this like really tight loop with your product manager, so you didn't feel like, hey, they're going to throw this over the fence at me, and right, that's what I'm going to design.
They're going to come up with some goals, and then we'll work against those goals. So they'll put a roadmap together, and then I'll deliver some designs against it. But really, just partnering.
Yeah, and you know, as design, you actually get to inspire the product function. You know, you get to inspire the engineering function, and obviously, like, still, I think to this day, like, engineers kind of still run Facebook. So, like, as an engineer, you can inspire the other functions, because like, you have the ability to just make, you know, there's so much like of an amazing developer experience like within the company to build all these things. And there's so many checks and balances that when you build a prototype, you get a lot of things for free. You can build really quickly. And then a designer can just be like, oh my God, this is 80% of the way there. I am for sure going to invest my time, even though this is not at all planned out right now. I'm going to for sure invest right, my Sunday to right, make sure this is right, basically.
Yeah. I didn't really need a diamond to get ahead of the second diamond in order to properly double diamond my life. I can just roll with this. The one thing we didn't touch on is that partnership with low barriers, lots of trust also means that there's not a lot of ego and there's a lot of comfort, right? Comfort and, oh, I can jump on late here and we can figure this thing out together.
There's also a depth of knowledge both ways, right? You don't have to be that technical of a person, but if you have a tight relationship with your engineer,
right,
you will have some layman understanding of, hey, what's happening here? And when they're out and someone else wants you to represent it, you can say, hey, I'm going to butcher this, but this is roughly kind of what's happening here. This is what we're doing here. Same goes for like product and like the business goals that are behind something. Every single person in the equation can in some way represent the team that very likely will not say something that is incorrect. But I also think that, you know, what you're saying with the trust thing and what you're saying with the low ego thing is if you find yourself in a review room or you find yourself in like a tough situation and having a discussion with an external party, then it's way more natural to back each other up. And so there's no throwing under the bus. There is all like, oh, we did this thing together. And if you then are more fortunate and you have like really solid processes across your organization, for example, or across the company or like standard escalation paths, whatever, then even that team that you don't know, that whose work you're affecting, they will actually be much more welcoming of what you're doing. Even if they're brought in later and they had no idea that you're working on it, you know, there's always going to be like, oh, that's not great. But then a lot of the time, at least I think we saw that probably because even the relationships within the discipline are really strong, like the relationships with, you know, tech leads across the company or the relationship with design leads across the company is like pretty tight, that can be the conduit of a great partnership across different teams, basically.
That's right. It becomes a chain. And so that means that the person with the, you know, designer with the relationship that's so good with their engineering partner translates to the three-step away tech lead, yeah, that carries that same chain of relationships, that graph extends. I was thinking about the kind of quality of partnership that you have as an IC with an engineer or PM and what that translates to as a leader. It was amazing working under Deb Liu because she really fostered a lot of that within her leadership team. So we would have, I mean, I think, you know, likely the most inclusive leadership team at Meta, often including every discipline to an extent, right? We'd have PMM in the room, in the leadership room, we'd have content design, research. So it wasn't just, oh, we'll have three or four. We'd have legal, sometimes HR would be in there. So it was just like a very tight knit, but fairly large group, sometimes nine or so of us. But we would have, to a degree, that interchangeable nature. That was a big part of my education too, right? I could really learn about what product marketing cared about and needed. I could really learn about what legal cared about and needed, which helps also reveal a lot of what goes into making scaled products, because it's not limited to the ability to make a thing that people want. There are a lot of other factors that go into it at a certain scale. Yeah, thinking about just a bunch of the PM leads that I worked with there, Karen Deep, Vivek, Yuli, really, truly interchangeable. And we would be like digging in the morning. I remember I had a portal because a lot of Vivek Sharma was in Seattle in our office and I was in Menlo. And so we just got the portals on our desks. Every morning we'd check in. He'd be on his dashboard. You know, we'd be talking about what we were observing in the data. And we were like in real time solving things like integrity issues that are not typically your UX concern, right? Oh, we have to go sharpen our ability to filter potentially scammy behavior and escalate that through our different human review workflows. It didn't matter that it wasn't a let's design a new feature or topic or let's go create a vision. It was like, we loved working through those problems together. Or much later with Yuli, once Deb left and we were sort of leading this team together with, you know, a couple other partners, we had to triage what Deb was doing before mm-hmm. amongst three or four of us. Yeah. And so we had to be interchangeable. And that was just an amazing relationship, but also skill to have where it was like, okay, I can carry enough of information from engineering, from PM, and they can carry enough for me. And we can just kind of go show up where we need to show up in any particular room.
I think that there's also something in there. You know, one of the things that I've said before, and we've definitely had conversations about in the past, is the importance of, as a leader, being predictable.
Right.
Someone who reports to you or someone that you work with can reverse engineer the way that you think. Yeah. And that way they can actually like speed themselves up quite a bit.
So exposing your thinking, right? So as a leader or just a partner, being able to like explain a bit why, having predictable frameworks, analogs. You know, we were talking about performance season. They're doing that right now at Meta. Every single performance season, I get somebody sending me a message like, oh, hey, we were talking about you today at PSCs. Mm-hmm. Somebody quoted one of your isms. I was like, it is like the most flattering thing somebody can do is to tell me that a hook that I would use persists. Yeah. Because it's just externalizing your thinking, let other people take and adapt it to their needs, right? But mm-hmm. as a leader, it's a pre-filter. You know, they can challenge your thinking and be ready to challenge your thinking because they know where you're going to be coming from. They can push you, but they can also mm-hmm. be efficient. I think a lot about how that worked with Kevin Systrom, right? I didn't get to work at Instagram, but just like the clarity of when people bring things to Kevin or brought things to Kevin, mm-hmm. they knew where he would land. Now, the mm-hmm. same is true as Adam. It was also true of Mark. Like, you could predict, we're going into this review with Mark. We have to have our data story together.
I think what's interesting about that, specifically also the times that I was at Instagram and you were at Facebook, and you also see how they learn and
right.
evolve and how fast that has to happen. Because, you know, the 2012, 2013 window was, oh, cool project. Like, you're going to be in a Mark review like 3 times a week.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and eventually there was enough trust for the layer of lieutenants. And also this realization that over time, as, you know, the CEO or the head of the product, you need to spend your time in different rooms.
There's other stuff to do. Yeah.
Yeah. You like that. And, but then still there's like this escalation path on, hey, if there's a tiebreaker or if we're getting close to something being launched or something being in a certain phase, well, then it still has to go, you know, up to Mark, like up to.
But it's not every step of the way. Yeah.
Yes.
I remember my first 3 Mark reviews were in 1 week when another designer was out. And so I carried their project into the room. And Mark and I debated like a couple of pixels of padding. He mm-hmm. wanted it dense. It needed yep. to be like within a reasonable touch target. And I was like, oh, this is where we're at. This is early 2013.
Yeah.
And then 3 years later on Marketplace, it was like monthly because it was a major new initiative. And they were almost like each one was a strategy progress. It was a business review.
I remember it was the 3rd week that we finally landed at the Facebook campus post-acquisition. And Mark expressed that he hated seeing the Instagram links in the text in newsfeed.
Oh, no way.
And
are we back to OG, to the OG shares?
Yeah. And so somebody needed to go and talk with Mark and the photos team, because like they right. use the photos API to like place something, about how were we going to resolve that. And so obviously Mark's message to Kevin, I think, was the links need to go.
Yeah.
And Kevin,
this
was
is
like,
a picture.
Hey, this is a giant inbound source for us. The links can't go. And so we basically went into a room. I think it was like, you know, Mark, Chris, Cheryl, the photos team, and then some of us from Instagram. And it was, I had a couple of different versions. One of them was, you know, putting the link in the robotext and say, hey, view on Instagram right. in the robotext. And then in the lightbox, which is the viewer that you open when you click on a picture in newsfeed, it would have a little Instagram icon in the corner and you could click on it. You can still link out, basically.
Right.
And so, you know, there was the original state, which had the small Instagram, like instagur.am URL in it, which was also an issue because that is a very specific country that has that TLD. Yeah, Armenia. So, you know, sure, no, like, you never know if that,
it gets that, like,
top level domain provider is going to be consistent, the same that, you know, we were dealing with Bitly and all this kind of stuff. I think it was Libya or something, right?
Right.
And so that was a kind of a risk, but not that big of a risk. But then the other risk was, well, are these links, like, discoverable enough? And then removing the link would just, like, completely kill any kind of inbound. And so we landed eventually on that view on Instagram link. But that was my first time being exposed to Mark in a review context. And I think we did one follow-up. We did two different ones. And kind of in the second one, we brought in some of the data just to, like, kind of prove that it was important to keep that. But it was also the first time that any team had requested to add something to the Robotext. Again, this is like 2012, right? So now there's, well, oh, well, the Robotext, like, can't be edited. So now we need to, like, talk to someone who can actually, like, work on the API for the Robotext so you can inject something that has a link in it and all this kind of stuff. But it was just like this really, like it's a very small thing in the grand scheme of things. But it at the time was something that, you know, you had to talk about. And
I think they had just standardized all of the newsfeed components. And I think that was maybe the last time until maybe the past year.
Yeah.
Yeah. Probably not very fancy. They didn't really fancy probably forking, but, you know, it's just Instagram. You probably want to do that.
Well, yeah. And the thing that I found interesting at that time was we were the ones that had to bring in the data. And, you know, that was, like, fine in that room. In the next couple of years, you know, Alex Schultz became kind of the arbiter of saying, yes, this data is clean. No, this data is not clean, right?
And Lord, does every company need that?
Exactly. And so that just meant that, like, a lot of these responsibilities of parts of the equation of making a decision were offloaded to lieutenants.
Yeah, because you can make data do what you want. You have to have some way of trusting it, right? Pre-Alex, that was just through the people.
Exactly. Like, okay, and then
this person's not going to bullshit me.
And you eventually learn the logic of every different leader. And so, like, that made sure that you would always be able to tailor, like, your messaging, right? But anyway, I think it's very interesting. And something that I took away from that was, you know, as soon as I started having more of a dedicated leadership role, not just, like, leading by doing, then it's about you need to teach others what you're doing as well. I was switching a team. Getting onto that new team, I was like, hey, here's how I think through these things. You know, like, the first time that I'm, like, working on something, it's like how I edited Craig's Figma file, basically, right? Like, hey, this is like, here is what is happening in every single one of these pictures, because the thing that the true lesson was the more experience you get in your job, the more things you do implicitly. And if you don't make those explicit, other people are like, they may not understand it, or they may want to challenge it on some basis that they actually don't have to. And so the more that they understand, like, why you're doing what you're doing, or why you're arguing for something in that direction, the more that they can also argue about the logic, or how the logic doesn't work in this way, or, like, how there's a different approach. And then you start seeing a set of recipes of different ways of thinking, and how they can actually, that diversity of thought can actually support each other. And it's a very explicit diversity of thought, because this type of person, you know, if you have, like, a Seth Weisfeld, you get, like, someone who's so productive and, like, you get these giant art boards and, like, very generative. And that's, like, a completely different way than how I work, which is way more methodical and, like, explaining the rule sets and all those kind of things. And then you have, you know, like, George Kettenberg, who's been, like, on the podcast before, who's, like, much more of a prototyper. And then you have Alex Cornell, who, like, will make you a video for it, you know, and, like, kind of talk you through it that way. And then you still have this, like, giant contingent of not just prototypers, but stages of company where designers can actually write code, or where you have engineers that are very design adjacent. And so they will be able to, like, you know, write your code. Or you have a PM who's, you know, very, like, has done, like, design in the past, or an engineer, like, who, like, or a PM who's been an engineer in the past. And I think that mobility, and that career mobility, and also that desire to kind of jump over into a different field with that whole, normally baggage often has a negative connotation, but that whole, like, package of baggage that you bring with you to just inform this new discipline is, like, super helpful, right?
And yeah, externalizing your thought in order to become not only a better partner, but to do more and do it faster, right? There's almost like it's an investment over time that just reduces the cost of any given conversation. Once you have that mind meld, the conversations get really quick. And then it becomes about scaling it to other people.
One of the things that we haven't covered yet is a lot of the time people don't do it because they don't want to give away their ideas. Obviously, that goes to a much deeper issue in an environment like that. But even secrets. I think one of the reasons why web design, before it kind of was product design, but like web design, web development, and then product design, and to this day, still engineering, people grew and the disciplines grew because everyone was talking online.
So open. Yeah.
Everyone was sharing things, you know, websites like CSS Tricks and Stack Overflow and like A List Apart way back in the day. And it feels to me nowadays that I think a lot of us are just in our jobs and we're like so busy with our actual jobs that at that moment in time, we were like, oh my God, there's like actually a profession here that is going to make me money. Holy crap. I think that we're now in that moment and you know, switching like life stages, like all those kind of stuff. Right. But I feel also like still structurally, there's a lot less like sharing of the why and the how.
Right.
And there's a much more of the sharing of the what. Hey, I did this, you know, kind of
well,
thing.
Some companies, you can't even share your work after you did it, let alone share while you're 100%. Doing it, or, you know, every single thought that went into it because a company owns it.
Yeah. But I do, yeah, I definitely think that because of that openness and sharing, you know, ideas are a dime a dozen, right? Is often the thing that's said.
Oh my God,
it's always about execution, right? So even sharing how to execute and how to execute very efficiently and how to collaborate with partners, kind of what we're doing here, like that is so key in making sure that as an industry, as a whole, as a function of mankind, like we should just keep on doing this kind of thing. And if you then go before the internet, everything in technology was proprietary.
Yeah, trade secrets.
Yeah, tech companies are even dealing with the fact that so few things are truly patentable.
Or defendable, yeah.
Or defendable as a patent, right? Yeah, you can patent it, but...
One way we grow is through feedback. Should we talk about feedback?
Feedback is a gift, Aaron. Feedback is often a gift, but feedback a lot of the time is also not so great.
Well, yeah, I think there's a difference between slander and compliments and feedback.
Yeah.
I think that's why we keep trying to qualify feedback, you know, constructive, actionable, right? Like you need another word to go with it. That's not just, you know, when the mic and the speaker disagree and everyone has their ears fried, like that's technically feedback.
Yes.
That's not what we're talking about here. We're not talking about the aggravators or the what's actually useful.
You know, one of the things that I found interesting is being from the Netherlands, moving to California around the 2012 mark.
Those are different cultures when it comes to feedback.
There's significantly different cultures. And the way that you discuss decisions that are made or the way that you give feedback to those decisions, like the Dutch are very direct, you know, very black and white. In California, a lot of padding in the language. But in some cases also, you know, that padding helps to work together through one of those situations. But to a Dutch person, it also seemed extremely inefficient, right? And so, but there, I think that there's this thing because you have this like kind of shared context of, you know, having a lot of curt, like direct, blunt people that is like the standard way of doing business. It just like,
it's not unidirectional either though, right? It is a give and take. It is argument, but to a resolution often, or at least to clarity on how two people think. I've found this with David Jalberg and you, my co-founder of Objective Subject, who's Quebecois. He enjoyed the art of debate. And I can easily get drawn into that. I bring a little bit more heat to it and get a little bit more personal at times. And it's something it's a lifelong journey. But it was always, we always got better ideas as a result of debating and challenging each other rather than saying, that's pretty good. Go ahead and do that. Mm-hmm. And that's what I found with you and with Jasper and Hugo and all that gang. It was always like, oh, we can actually push this further if we're very obvious about like, oh, that could be better.
One of the things that's in there though, and I think that's what made the folks you mentioned quite compatible even in California, is that it is a very direct value assessment, or there's very direct feedback, but then there's also an example of a solution, or it's often not just purely, you know, a wall that gets thrown up.
Oh, that's not very good.
Yeah, but that's like also part of, you know, there's a lot of the, I think in Australia they call it tall poppy syndrome, but there's a lot of this Dutch culture where, you know, don't try and stand out. Don't try to do something too crazy. And I think you need to have a little bit of a anti-systemic approach to that culture to even come out here and then bring kind of the superpower of clarity in that, but that's also right. be very productive, right? I always think about how, we're talking a little bit about the specifics of feedback around work. It's also this thing where it's performance cycle season.
Behavior.
Right? There's like behavioral feedback, right? That can sometimes be like, if you have a great manager and you have a good, and you have good systems in place, that can be very helpful. I also think that if you are in a system that is, you know, completely not for you, and oftentimes there's a lot of privilege involved with you being in an environment that like truly supports you and like truly wants to help you grow, while other corporate entities and organizations will talk the talk but not walk the walk, basically. And so being in like a bad environment where feedback is weaponized can
right.
not just like affect you because there's bad faith feedback putting you in like the wrong direction. It can also have a long window of time that effect then goes into. So like you may be on like a wild goose chase trying to be a better person, or even if the feedback is like, oh, you need to be better at craft, but you're just like not like that craft oriented of a designer, it doesn't really help you. It doesn't really like solve like your thinking into the future. It just kind of makes you deal with a liability instead of right. giving you feedback about a behavior, right? And so one of the things that I really liked about the Facebook way, and something that I've just kind of taken with me, is, you know, when you go into management at Facebook, they give you, I don't know if they still do it, but at the time they just give you this book called First Break All the Rules. It's this Marcus Buckingham book. And the core of it is basically strength-based feedback.
That's right.
Strength-based yeah. like growth. It wasn't until that point where I was introduced to that concept where you actually, I didn't even know that about that feedback culture until I was in the room, like getting management training, that it was all like focused on strength-based feedback. And a lot of my frustration with past managers at the company at the time that I had to deal with was, I don't feel like that we're talking the same language even. I don't think that you care about the things that I care about. I don't think that you're trying to like, quote unquote, help me to grow. Because a lot of my strengths at the time was this hybrid approach, designer engineer thing. And what was happening, you know, when you have to kind of go into the Facebook IC5, but generally like the middle to high senior band at a company like that, is you have to kind of let some of that go. You have to kind of let some of that superpower right. go and embrace this ability to drive strategy and help drive decision making. And that just wasn't explained. It's also not in the ladder. You know, so that doesn't really help. But then when you get that explained in a very like healthy, supportive way, all of a sudden there's that unlock.
That's right.
I know you had a really good experience at Marketplace receiving feedback about what actually your job was apart yeah. from being like the design leader.
Yeah. Deb is known for being a people sponsor and mentor, and she also externalizes a lot of her thinking and her writing. But one of the things that she said in my first weeks on the team, after kind of observing me in a few of her meetings, and there were meetings I didn't really know my role in, where I was like in meetings where it was like very clearly about topics that were in my wheelhouse, it was fine. But like the first few weeks, she's like, I'm not sure you're ready for this job to be the head of design for Marketplace. At the time, the design team was like six. Right? Not a big thing. It wasn't even like a big product yet. It was barely even out the gates.
Yeah.
By the time she had given me this feedback, she was like, I just don't know what you think. And I was like, to the point of like externalizing your thinking, if the people who are effectively your boss don't know what you think, that's really bad. And I didn't see that as a kind of job prereq until she said that. And then fast forward maybe a year or something, there was a sort of build on that feedback, which is like, you're paid for your opinions. And you might see yourself, because your title is design manager and you're not a director yet, because that you see yourself as a manager of designers and that you mm-hmm. lead the function of design. But if you want to get to the next level, if you want to become a director and you want to actually be an executive at a company, you got to stop thinking in those terms. What would you do if you were the head of design at one of the biggest e-commerce companies? How would you behave differently than you do today? And I was like, oh yeah, I would do different things. She was like, but you are.
Yeah.
For the third time working with her, I like, my world was shattered. My ego was thrown back out the window and rebuilt. But I mean, recasting your understanding of your job and ignoring the latter and actually thinking about what is my role or what is the role that I want. In fact, I think I just recently gave a version of that feedback to a friend. She was interviewing for pretty senior roles at pretty real companies. And, you know, one of the exciting roles was cool from a people you could work with thing, but it was not a head of job. And it was at a place that had not, that probably should, but hadn't centralized the design team. And she was saying that. She was like, I think that they should do that. Maybe I'll just, you know, try to get in and change it. And I was like, is that what like the white men interviewing for this role are going to say? Is that like the thing that you want to wait to do? And she's like, no, I'm sure any other candidate might say that's what they need in order to take the job. I was like, go ahead. She's like, I'm going to try it. And she did. And within like 24 hours, she's talking to the CEO about how they were thinking the same thing. And so it's just like recasting, like in that role, you're not just an interviewee for a job. You want to be the head boss. You take the play of whatever that's, you know, just imagine for a minute what the head boss that you're, you know, envisioning would do. And what's funny about that is I think that, first of all, I probably wouldn't have done it. It actually took her being that bold. It's not the advice. It's not the feedback. It's the willingness. It's the action, right? Just like the idea is cheap. Mm-hmm. But even better is like, I gave her that feedback because I envisioned her as that person. Mm-hmm. And the thing I've always admired is that she's the say the thing, do the thing person. Mm-hmm. So sometimes you just need the reminder to recast your own perception and role. Because the job description she was looking at did not say that. I was like, you see the opportunity. Yeah. Maybe they should too. In a way, just paying the same feedback forward from Deb.
That is also very typical for the design function to kind of just stick to the design aspects of the thing.
Right? Stick to the brief.
stick to the brief. There's been this, like, I think 15-year window now that we're in where designers have wanted to be pulled into leadership positions and then find themselves in more leadership positions. But then even within that realm, they often don't want to express their business opinion, or they don't want to express their engineering opinion because, you know, the other people are
not my lane,
the experts. And that probably also comes from having experiences in the past where people were giving their design opinions the whole time. And you're like, these people don't know what the hell they're
talking about, this clown.
So there's a lot of projection in that kind of that circle of logic. But it is extremely important as a design leader, if you find yourself next to your product manager or next to an engineering manager or in a room with, you know, a leader from sales or wherever you find yourself, to have knowledge and an opinion that you can give about the context that your work lives in. And that context includes business goals, that context includes important, like different like pulls from like and priorities from different parts of the company that you may not know about. And even if you don't know about them and you learn about them in that room, to like then move kind of fast and discuss through that. And I don't think that is something that we have accepted as a design function yet.
Right.
I've seen over and over again, different companies, different times, is to go into the quote unquote staff role, there's two major ways of thinking. Either it is purely about the skill of design. You have to be prolific. And certain companies, I think Shopify is one of those companies that definitely allows you to get into that. And I think Facebook over time kind of unlocked that lower staff role. But for the longest time, the thing circa 2016, 2015, to get into staff is business acumen. It is connecting your work to the impact that your team, your organization, your business needs to do. And I still am in the camp of that is actually the bridge to cross to do an in-house staff job. Even though I think that there is also a world now where if you have, you know, certain specialties like design systems and like prototyping and this kind of stuff, you can find yourself into a role like that.
Yeah.
Rarely have I find one of those people who has that specialization not also know exactly why that specialization is important.
Why it's valuable in the company, business. Yeah.
What value it brings to the business, you know?
Yeah. It's, you know, for a long time, it felt like, and maybe I still see this advice, it's, you know, you're there on behalf of the user. You're there for being the people-centric side. Well, you can't really do things for the user or for people if it's not worth the business's time to do. Because ultimately, the business exists to be in business. And it's not a cynical thing. It's not a bad thing. It's not late-stage capitalism. It is simply, we can keep doing this in service of our customers so long as our business can have its doors open. And so if you can't connect what people need and want to what business needs and want, then you're not going to have that impact and you won't be very people-centric, will you? Because you can't actually do the thing. I've actually found those partners and man, just so many of them in data scientists.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Whether in leadership roles with my partner's Nav or Ashish, or earlier in my career with like folks like Ian, it was like, I need to understand what's happening through the numbers in addition to what happens through what is more comfortable for me, which was UXR. Let me go and figure out how to speak this language, how to understand, you know, everything from reaching product market fit and what the different stages are, how you're going to measure each stage, through how do you assess what's happening in the product in real time, and then do the deep dive into why that's happening based on the dashboards, or how we're experimenting, what the experiments do to our customers' experience as they switch in and out of, you know, all of these things end up mattering quite a lot. And they're very far outside of the normal realm of the Bachelor of Fine Arts, you know, base designer than I am. And I find to this day that being really aware of, competent with, you know, the data enables me to make much better, more people-centric decisions, to lead with vision, even though data is always in the past, right? That one for me has always been, that's feedback that I give folks, right? Okay, you've got to understand this. The guidance is always find your engineer. It's find your data partner. Who is willing to take the time because you're interested in helping you understand what's going on with the data, that you can build confidence in the data that is being read back when your idea doesn't work according to the data. It can feel very painful. And it's like, well, we're so metrics driven. Of course, we're not going to ship my brilliant idea, my really well-crafted thing, because that's all we ever care about. That won't get you very far. If you show that you're really capable of understanding the data and you're still making the argument for this is better because, you know, the intangibles, et cetera, it's always more credible than like you're the person that always says we're too data driven. I want to ship the thing that I think is nice. That's not going to stand as well.
What you're reminding me of is we talked a lot about the relationship with your engineer, the relationship with your product manager.
Right.
Whatever new place you join in your career or team you switch to, or what's often just forgotten about or that people kind of don't have on their radar, is find the woman or man who is the data person on that team. They are the go-to person to figure out anything. They will go dig. They are very proactive, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
You can bring a question that is fairly high level or ambiguous,
and they will be kind of that partner, again, like the engineering relationship.
They'll take the challenge.
But then there's also the aspect of, you know, from the business angle, is go find the administrative assistant or exec assistant or the chief of staff or a combination of that to just actually learn really quickly on the ground what's going on. Because a lot of those people in the context, especially of tech, and I'm going to say it like this, but I don't really mean like this. A, they're the most normal. And you know, they're just basically like the easiest to talk to, but also they can cut through the crap of the Kool-Aid and stuff and will give you an honest take. B, they have access to a lot of information and they will be both really helpful to you and you'll learn a lot from them, and also have immense amounts of discretion while doing that. But they will also be the people that can connect you to the other people that you should know and learn, and are kind of the hidden operating forces within the team, within the organization, within the company. Those two often get really overlooked early on when like you join a team or a company.
I think that's brilliant advice for anybody when it comes to feedback. Find the people who won't give you the varnished answer. Find the people who are willing to give you the straight shit. And I think that is a huge advice, to look for those folks who are like the team glue, those chief of staff, executive assistants. They don't really have the time and they have no incentive.
And they also never get the credit for like the amount of weight that they carry in the context of a company. I think, I forget who it was, someone at the Golden Globes during an acceptance speech actually thanks everyone's assistants. Because they were making everything run on time, which is 100% the case, especially because the quote unquote talent gets to be heads down. Like the talent won't be able to be heads down if the operators around the talent can actually do the work. I think that there's a lot of interesting, this is maybe a topic for a different time because, you know, we're at time and we should probably like start wrapping up, but a lot of what we look at right now is, you know, we work in this environment that like kind of has been the tech 2010s zero interest rate phenomenon, like way of working. And a lot of what is still interesting to look at is, you know, how do movie studios work? You know, like how do movies get made? and quote unquote, the talent in that context. A lot of them have an assistant or have operators around them to make the thing work so they can focus on their actual strength, basically.
And that's a lot of bless the project managers.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you know, in tech, it's you don't need a project manager, you need a product manager. And that person needs to have opinions and be like a part of the trio and blah, 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 blah. Meanwhile, we completely discard like the need of someone to keep us on track and on time. And that becomes 5-10% of the PM's job, 5-10% of the EM's job, and because the NDICs are protected in a way. But there, I think
it's like engineering managers, please run effective meetings.
Yeah.
Is that their strong suit?
Is that really their job? Yeah. The engineering managers often got there because they were also really great engineers. That is not the best use of their time. We are paying them way too much to do that.
Meeting agendas. That's expensive meeting agendas.
Like stand-ups are great, but like giant team stand-ups where all of a sudden you have, you know, 15, 30 minutes of 20 people and every single person there makes over $200K a year. It's a very expensive way to start your week, you know. Anyway, yeah, I think that there's something we can kind of learn and evolve into by bringing in some really solid just operators and people that have those qualities and those skills to keep us all on track much better than we can. Because it's kind of like the inmates are running the asylum right now in most of these cases, you know?
Yeah. I think being able to run a great team meeting is a discipline. Very fortunate that chiefs of staff are a thing, that head of operations is a thing, and that I've been able to bring in Emma White as my head of design operations. She has been a game changer, and it's something that Meta doesn't do, you know? So design program management sort of backed into that a bit. And you end up finding different ways to sort of excuse having some capacity for operational excellence when it doesn't seem like something you should have to excuse. It should just be a necessary thing, because I'll tell you, things get done. And it's not like, oh, it fell off, you know, your priority list and so it wasn't worth anyone doing. No, it just wasn't the urgent, necessary sort of like thing that took me away from everything else I was wanting to get done, and all this important stuff just left me languish. And by the way, at this huge leverage point, which is my entire organization slash like the group that I work with, where everything that my team do could be done better and then make everyone go faster, right? Having somebody who just does that.
I think that there's also a level of empowerment in there where like, it's not just you, quote unquote, asking for them to do this, right? Because like you have other things on your mind, but you actually have a really strong lieutenant that is then also empowered and taken seriously that like-
And when, strategic in their own right, yeah.
When this person comes to you, it's like, well, like you better get your stuff together, because otherwise, you know, sure, it's not Aaron that's like coming down right now telling us that we're lagging behind on this, but pretty close. So probably should get our ducks in a row.
Yeah, it's one Slack away. Absolutely. I mean, all the work that we did on career ladders that then became our performance tools, that then became our performance assessment tool, which laddered into our performance summary cycle and calibrations tool. I mean, the impact that that had, I got to cancel two entire days of calibrations because everything came back on target. I read a bunch of packets, spot checked a bunch of stuff. It was all clean. Everyone used the tools properly. They had really great instructions for how to use them. We had training to get people up to speed on it. And now that is a machine that runs, and it runs better than any version of that machine that I've had the chance to operate. And it's only because we had excellence in the discipline of creating those machines.
Plus the amount of money that you just saved the company, because those 2 days didn't have to be spent on calibration.
We got to do a lot more design.
Yeah. It can actually be spent on the thing that like, you know, directly has an effect on the company.
And everyone got a little bit better feedback as a result.
Man, we went through a bunch. I just want to say thank you so much for taking the time and for, you know, sharing your knowledge. I mean, I always love hanging out with you. So this was a great excuse to do this again.
Thanks, Michael.
Thanks again for listening. If you aren't a subscriber yet, you should totally check out some of the other episodes. So hit that subscribe button. And if you're looking for some of the top episodes, go to fullstackwhatever.com.